the need for cooperation essential to the fund. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman.
My dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and my dear young people. Well, as our Chairman has rightly said, we've moved now, of course, into the story of the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 8 in more detail. We've looked at the background, you remember, of the story of the fund and how it all began. The problem of Judaism as it began to loom large in the Jerusalem Ecclesia, and how the apostle conceived this idea of gathering together a collection that would be inspired by the motive power of grace in the life of the Gentile ecclesias. You'll remember that in the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 8 and in the first few verses, in fact the first 9 verses that we looked at by way of exhortation on Sunday, how the Apostle Paul lifts the thinking of the brethren by the time he's finished to the very themes of the offering of our Lord Jesus Christ himself. How that he saw the very matter of the collection of money in such lofty tones as to compare it with the offering of Christ. We saw that even in such mundane matters as our own collections partaken of and freely given Sunday by Sunday, that there is in fact an apostolic appropriateness that we do so hard on the heels of the breaking of bread, that we might relate the principle of our own giving to that of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well then, by way of further study this evening, we're going to look now at the second part of the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 8, and we're going to see why it was so important that the Ecclesia cooperate greatly in this particular matter. Just before we move on, however, though, I thought we might take the opportunity, seeing we didn't have it on Sunday evening, or Sunday morning rather, just to cover the three, what I believe to be the three key words of the 2nd of Corinthians 8 and 9. I believe that there are three key words that are found throughout these two particular chapters, and that in these three words we have a synopsis of all that the apostle intended to accomplish. Well, the first word, as we've said already, is the Greek word charis, the word translated grace, on the part of the bestower, that which conveys the friendly disposition from which the kindly act proceeds. It's a word that stresses the freeness, the spontaneous character of that which is given. And on the part of the receiver, a sense of the favour bestowed and a feeling of gratitude for that grace which has been received. A word that's found, as we discovered, which occurs 10 times in the course of these two particular chapters. Grace times 2, extended to both Jew and Gentile. So there really is the key word that the apostle builds his arguments around in these two particular chapters. But it's only one of three key words. The second word is the Greek word parousia. It's a word translated abound or abundance, and it's found on several occasions throughout these two particular chapters. It's a word that means literally an exceeding measure above the ordinary. That which is superabundant in quantity and superior in quality. A word that which denotes that which is preeminent, that which is beyond measure, that which is overflowing. You can almost sense the idea of parousia here, a word that bubbles up and overflows above and beyond that which is deemed to be necessary. And then the third key word is diakonos, the word translated quite commonly, of course, minister or ministration. A word that means to act as a servant or an attendant, to wait upon or to minister to the needs of others. And in these three words, we believe we have the whole spirit of what this fund was all about and what spirit the apostle wanted to inspire in the hearts of the brethren. What he wanted was that spirit of grace that would so act in a person's life that they would spontaneously abound in an overflowing spirit of ministering to the needs of others. That's what the apostle's talking about in these two chapters. That the spirit of grace at work in the life of the individual would inspire them to overflow in a spirit of ministering to the needs of others. And if we can just focus on those three words and get that down into those two chapters, we really have the whole spirit of what the apostle is trying to deal with in this particular section of the 2nd of Corinthians chapters 8 and 9.
Now, just a brief review then of the first 12 verses, which we did look at in the main by way of exhortation on Sunday, just to remind ourselves then as to where we've come in the argument. You'll remember that in the first 5 verses, the apostle brought forth the example of the Macedonian ecclesias. And he brought it forth specifically that he might highlight the grace of extreme generosity that flowed forth from those ecclesias. Remember how he said, marvellous, that they gave out of their deep poverty. And so the apostle brought forth the marvellous example of the Macedonians in order to stimulate the Achaean ecclesias themselves to a gracious act of giving. And then in verses 6 to 8 he does just that. He makes an appeal to the Achaean ecclesias for a similar demonstration of their own genuine love in the truth. Remember what he said? He says, I can't force you. He says, I'm not giving you an order. I just want to test the keenness of your enthusiasm against what other people have already done. And by means of that skillful marshalling of arguments, he sought to encourage their hearts in this matter. And then, lest they should think that this was merely a matter of provincial rivalry, he reminded them, did he not, in the 9th verse, that really the example we're following is that of the Lord himself. That spirit of selfless giving for the needs of others, as the 9th verse says, we know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor. And finally, in verses 10 to 12, which we didn't look at and won't have time to consider this evening, he then stresses the need to match their initial enthusiasm with which they began the collections with a practical performance that would see them finally brought to a conclusion. So just looking again then at that spirit of the Lord, that spirit of having given them the example of the Macedonians, he then gives them the example of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. We might just review those quotations that we considered together on Sunday morning. And so here it is. Galatians 1, the Lord Jesus Christ who gave himself for our sins. Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. The 1st of Timothy 2, the man Christ Jesus who gave himself a ransom for all, says Timothy. And Titus 2, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us. Titus chapter 2. You see that there's the three key words of these two chapters found in other places concerning the work of the Lord himself. Acts chapter 15, we believe that through the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ we shall be saved. Romans 5, the gift by grace which is by one man hath abounded unto many. There's our second key word. Mark chapter 10, for even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, diakonos, and to give his life a ransom for many, is the testimony, of course, of Mark chapter 10. And there was the spirit that the apostle wished the Achaean ecclesias to emulate. That spirit of selfless giving for others that he extracts out of the sacrificial offering of our Lord Jesus Christ, as verse 9 says, it was all done for your sakes. And in that marvellous way, the apostle lifts their thinking to a contemplation of things far and above, beyond the mere tinkle of cash into the bags, as it were, and to the motive spirit itself with which we give for the work of the truth. Well, let's have a look at what we're going to consider then by way of study this evening. We're going to look then at the balance of this 8th chapter, and from verses 13 to 15, he's now going to bring forth the example of Israel in the past to show the virtues of cooperation and sharing together. That the spirit of cooperation was absolutely essential in order that this fund might be brought to a successful conclusion. And then from verses 16 to 19, and again from 22 to 23, he's going to bring forth the example of the commissioners of the fund and look at their credentials of earnest care and zeal for the truth that was to be so powerful an influence for good in this particular matter. And then the example of himself in verses 20 and 21. As the apostle showed a marvellous care that he would provide against any unwarranted criticism of those things that he was endeavouring to accomplish in this collection. And finally, in the 24th verse, a final appeal for loving cooperation. So you see, he really wanted to stress in this particular part of the chapter the need for their cooperation, not only for their enthusiasm, but also that there was a principle of cooperation involved here if the fund was to be brought to a successful conclusion. Well then, verses 13 to 15, the example of Israel, the virtues of cooperation and sharing. Let's have a look at what he says then from the 13th verse onwards in this story. Well, he goes on to say in verse 13, "For I mean not that other men be eased and ye burdened, but by an equality." The word eased found in verse 13 literally means that which provides relaxation or relief, and the word burdened is the Greek word thlipsis, which of course means pressure. So you see, what the apostle was saying in the 13th verse is, he says, now look, he says, I don't want you to think that what we're going to do here in taking money from you is going to give relief to others, but only increase enormous pressure on yourself. In other words, he says, we're not trying to reverse the situation from where it is at the moment. And I believe that the reason why the apostle said that was because, you see, there's always some in the ecclesia that would have raised that argument. They would have said, now look, you know, if you take our money and give it to the ecclesia at Jerusalem, then they'll be well off and we'll be poverty stricken, and all we've done is change places. You see, there are always those in ecclesial life that have some reason why we ought not to give for the work of the truth, for whatever purpose it might be. The apostle knew that would be those that would be negatively minded, those that have always got an excuse why they ought not to give of their time and of their resources for the good of the truth. He says, look, we're not trying to put you in the position of pressure and others into the position of relief that you currently enjoy. No, he says, what we want is an equality, verse 14. We want an equality. And the word means likeness in condition or proportion. There was to be a balancing out of things. The Jerusalem Bible translates it that way. It says it's a question of balancing things. Well, what was the balance that the apostle had in mind? Well, he says in verse 14 that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want. Actually, the word want, by the way, means perhaps more specifically deficiency. It's even translated as poverty. It wasn't what the Jerusalem ecclesia wanted, was it? It wasn't their wants so much as their deficiency or their poverty. So you see, set off on the one side was their abundance, and on the other side, Jerusalem's deficiency. Well, he says, notice what he says in verse 14, that now at this time, your abundance may be a supply for their want. And the implication of what the apostle says in verse 14 is that, you see, the cycle of life is always turning around, and that the day could come in the future where they themselves would need to be supplied from the abundance of others. He says, don't ever forget that. You may have the ability now whilst others have the deficiency, but the implication of the verse is that at some unstated time in the future, their abundance also may be a supply for your want. So there's going to be a balancing. There could also be, of course, in the idea of abundance and deficiency here, the spirit of Romans 15, which you don't need to turn to, but Romans 15 verse 27, when it says, "For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things." And so maybe the abundance that they had was carnal things, and the deficiency that the Jerusalem ecclesia had was carnal things, but that on the other side, the abundance of the truth had come from Judea and had reached out to supply their want. Either way, whichever interpretation we give to the 14th verse, this sense of necessary equality prevails. So he says it at the start and at the end of the verse, "But by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written," says the apostle, "he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack." Now, where does that come from? Well, those that were fortunate enough to dine with the Speaker last night will know, of course, and it shouldn't have mattered where you were dining, those that did the daily readings yesterday will know, of course, that this is a quotation from Exodus 16. We might just have a look at this, because I tell you what, this is a very interesting passage that the Apostle quotes in this context. He says, "Not that ye should be burdened and other men relieved, but that there should be an equality, that their abundance may supply your want, that your abundance may supply their want, as it is written." And then he quotes the terms of Exodus 16, and specifically he's quoting from the 18th verse. However, we're going to start our consideration from the 16th verse. Exodus 16, verse 16. "This is the thing which Yahweh hath commanded. Gather of it every man according to his eating, an omer for every man, according to the number of your persons. Take ye every man for them which are in his tents." And the children of Israel did so, and gathered, some more, some less. And when they did meet it with an omer, he that gathered much — here's the apostle's quotation now — "he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. And Moses said, let no man leave of it till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was wroth with them. And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. And when the sun waxed hot, it melted." Now you've got to stop and think about this for a moment in terms of what actually happened. We're told that, you see, the children of Israel went out to gather every man according to his eating, and they were entitled, each one, to have an omer of manna, verse 16. An omer for every man. So away they went to gather their omers of manna each morning. But verse 17 says that they didn't actually do that, because verse 17 says, "And the children of Israel did so, and gathered, some more, some less." So you see, what happened according to the record of Exodus was that when they came back with their baskets, some had far more than an omer, and some had far less. Now you see, there could have been all sorts of reasons why people's gathering ability varied. It could have been that some had large families, that they got up earlier in the morning than others. They got out smart, they got on with the job, they were enthusiastic. It could be also, however, that there were those who were lame, those who were crippled, those whose eyesight was failing them, who could not see clearly to pick the manna off the ground, those whose hands were frail. You see, there could have been all sorts of different reasons why some gathered more and some gathered less. The funny thing was, though, says verse 18, that when they did meet it with an omer — so what do? They meted it with an omer, says the record. So the word "meet," by the way, means to measure. When you stop and think about it, what Exodus 16 and verse 18 is telling us is that irrespective of whether they gathered some more or some less, that what they actually did was that they all put the collection of manna into a common pool. And then they measured it out with an omer, and every person went away with that which had been measured out. And you know what they found? They found that he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. So you see, those that for whatever reason had been unable to gather an omer for their eating were supplied. Their deficiency was supplied by the overabundance of others. And others who may have been able to gather more, necessarily, having given their contribution to the common stock, only took out what they required, and as a result of that, they sacrificed the additional amount that they had collected. Here was the spirit of mutual cooperation and sharing. And you know what they found? They found that irrespective of what they'd gathered, that when it was measured out with an omer, that every person was satisfied. Nobody went without. Even those that had foregone the most had exactly an omer left unto them. He that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. And so you see, God gave a very gracious and very wise rule for the gathering and distribution of the manna, and there was a spirit whereby some learnt to sacrifice for the needs of others, and it was taken out of a common stock. Now you think about how that applies in other things besides manna. Relates to the distribution of the manner of life, doesn't it, in ecclesial life. There could be those who are more able to gather the manner of life. And one of the purposes of ecclesial life is that the manner of life, the bread of life, might be measured out with an omer, that every man might have according to his eating, irrespective of whether there were some who were able to gather more or some who were able to gather less. It doesn't matter. Ecclesial life sees that those things are measured out, that every person might be spiritually satisfied by their association one with the other. And everybody had sufficient to meet their needs. It was a divine provision that all needs might be met. And the ecclesia in Israel learnt the virtues of mutual cooperation. And you know what, brothers and sisters? That must be what that passage means. Because what the apostle is doing, of course, in quoting that passage in the context of the 2 Corinthians 8, is to say that, and this is what he says, remember, that your abundance may supply their deficiency, that there might be an equality, as it is written, and quotes this illustration out of the episode of the children of Israel to show how one's abundance supplied another's deficiency, that there could be equality between all of them. And there was a real barb in this quotation, because we're told in the 20th verse that there were those who didn't really want to put everything into the common stock. Those that wanted to keep a little extra back for themselves until the morning. Those who had the Ananias and Sapphira spirit of not really wanting to contribute, that there might be equality. And those that had that spirit, those who endeavoured to hoard, found that their excess conferred no benefit on them at all, because it bred worms and stank. Oh, that was a clever quotation. Well, imagine the apostle quoting that to those that he's now about to appeal to give money generously to the Jerusalem Poor Fund. He says, now, brethren, just remember what happened to the little bit that people kept back, won't you? So that was a good quotation to use, wasn't it? The benefits of mutual cooperation together, marvellously drawn out of the lesson of the manna here in Exodus chapter 16. Well, let's come back then to the 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and follow through the argument now as the apostle moves from the virtues of cooperating together in order to stress the credentials of the commissioners of the fund who were going to be sent to the ecclesias in order to complete the gatherings. We're told in the 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 15, verse 16, he says, but thanks be to God, and now from verse 16 to verse 19, and also in verses 22 and 23, he's going to talk now about the commissioners of the fund. He says, thanks be to God, which put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. By the way, the word thanks there is our Greek word charis, grace. Grace be to God, who hath put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. Put the same earnest care, says the apostle. Same as what? Same care as who? And I think that on this occasion, the sameness of care that Titus had was in fact the same as the apostle himself. If you come back to the 7th chapter, just one page back, in the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 7, and in verse 12 we're told, wherefore, though I wrote unto you, I did it not for his cause that had done the wrong, nor for his cause that had suffered wrong, but that our earnest care for you in the sight of God might appear unto you. And the word care there is the same word translated earnest care in chapter 8 and verse 16. So when the apostle says, thanks be to God which put the same care into the heart of Titus, I believe that the care that the apostle had in mind that Titus showed was the same as his own. That's certainly how a number of other translations take up the meaning of the text. Moffat says, he has an interest in you equal to my own. The Jerusalem Bible says, he has the same concern for you. The 20th century New Testament translation says, he has the same keen interest in your welfare that I have. Now we want to just make comment on that word, earnest care, just for a moment, as it occurs in chapter 8 and verse 16. It's actually a very important word in this particular chapter. It's a key word, we might add. We haven't put it down as one of the key words to the two chapters because it only occurs in chapter 8, but it does occur several times. It's the Greek word spoude, S-P-O-U-D-E. It means to be diligent, to be zealous, to be earnest, to be eager. It's a lovely word. It's a very strong word. Now, here's where it's translated. Verse 7, it's the word translated diligence, in all diligence. Verse 7, spoude. It's the word in verse 8 translated forwardness, by occasion of the forwardness, the eagerness, the enthusiasm of others. It's the word translated, as we've seen, earnest care in verse 16, the same earnest care, spoude. It's the word translated more forward in verse 17. More forward. It's the word translated diligent in verse 22. The brother whom we have oftentimes proved diligent, spoude, enthusiastic, eager in many things. And it's also the word translated in that verse, but now much more diligent. And so here we have a word that's used 6 times, in fact, in the course of this chapter. It's a key word in the 8th chapter. The spirit of the commissioners of the fund was the spirit of zealous, earnest care for the needs of others. Now, look what it says, therefore, in the 16th verse. He says, grace be to God, which put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. Now, you see, Titus was an earnest man. And yet it says here in the record that God did that. It says that God put that earnest care into the heart of Titus. And so what we're shown here is the way in which God works in and through the individual. There's no conflict of terms there. It's really the spirit of Philippians chapter 2, isn't it? To work out your own salvation, for it is God that worketh in you. And here we have a man whose singular enthusiasm in the truth is attributed to the very Spirit of God providentially at work in his life. And he certainly was at work in the life of this man, Titus, who was so important to the gathering of this fund. Verse 17 goes on to say about him, says, for indeed he accepted the exhortation, but being more forward of his own accord, he went unto you. He accepted the exhortation, says the apostle. What exhortation was that? What was the exhortation that Titus accepted? Well, it's related to what he says in the 6th verse. In verse 6, the word desired, the word translated desired in verse 6 is the same word translated exhortation. It's parakaleo, to call near. So in fact, if we translate the word desired as exhortation in verse 6 of the 8th chapter, it makes more sense. So we read verse 6 and then verse 17, we have, insomuch that we exhorted Titus, that as he had begun, so he would also finish in you the same grace also. Verse 17, for indeed he accepted the exhortation, but being more forward of his own accord, he went to. So the exhortation that Titus accepted was the charge that the apostle gave him that he should go back to the ecclesias of Achaia and complete their collections for the Jerusalem Poor Fund. That was the particular exhortation that Titus accepted on this occasion. And with what spirit did he accept the apostle's charge? Well, it says that he was more forward. You know how that it happens even in the English language and so also in the Greek, that you can have the same word expressed in various levels of intensity. So the word earnest care in verse 16 is the word spoude in its normal form. Then we have the comparative form in verse 22, translated more diligent, more earnestly caring. That's the comparative form of the verb spoude. In the 17th verse, though, the word is in the superlative, and it ought to be translated, being very earnest of his own accord he went unto you. It's the superlative form of this same word. And that was the spirit, you see, of Titus. He accepted the exhortation, but being very earnest of his own accord, he went unto you. Now, there's a remarkable spirit here that's shown by Titus. I want you to stop and think about this. You know, Titus was sent to Corinth at a time of great difficulty. The ecclesia had turned away from the apostle. There were all sorts of dreadful accusations being made against Paul. And Paul sent Titus back to the Corinthians in order to try and solve some of those difficult problems. Titus went down to Corinth from Macedonia, where the apostle was, and he spent time with the Achaean ecclesias. He came back up to Macedonia, where the apostle was, and he told Paul that all was well. And now Paul writes this epistle and is ready now to send it back to the Achaeans, in order that their collections might be completed. And he said he exhorted Titus that he might complete those collections. And he says he accepted the exhortation, but being very earnest, he did it, in fact, of his own accord. He went willingly and voluntarily. He didn't have to be asked by the apostle. You know, what happened here was, you know, Titus has gone all the way down to Achaia. He's come all the way back, and Paul says, look, he says, I'm absolutely thrilled, Titus, and what I'd like you to do, Titus, is I'd like, Titus, he's gone. He'd already gone. He didn't have to be asked by the apostle. The NIV says he went on his own initiative. Moffat says he's off to you by his own choice. So keen is his interest. You know, brothers and sisters, this time was winter time. I don't believe that Titus went by sea. I believe he went by land. He went 500 miles from Macedonia down to Achaia. He went 500 miles back to report that to the apostle. No sooner as he got back than the apostle says, here's a letter I want you to take it. Titus says, see ya, and he's off. 500 miles down again, and 500 miles back finally to Macedonia before they finally went to... This man travelled 2,000 miles on that particular matter. Earnest care, says the word. Isn't that earnest care? You know, we just don't have people like that, do we? We just don't have people like that in ecclesial life today. A man who was absolutely motivated, self-motivated, of his own accord. These men such as Titus, gave themselves to the work. They gave themselves to the work of the truth. You know, we live in an age today of mediocrity, don't we? Where the average and the ordinary is accepted as being acceptable. It's never acceptable in the truth. The truth is all about vigour. The truth is all about enthusiasm. The truth is all about dedication. The truth is all about whole burnt offerings. And burnt offerings that are given willingly. And Titus was a superb example of that. Paul says, I didn't have to ask him. He'd gone. Of his own accord, just like that. 2,000 miles that brother travelled on that to prosecute that one particular cause. An amazing spirit. Absolutely wonderful spirit. And if that wasn't enough, verse 18 says, and we've sent with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the ecclesias, and not that only, but who was also chosen of the ecclesias to travel with us with this grace which is administered by us to the glory of the same Lord and declaration of your ready mind. We've sent with him a brother, another brother, as another man who would be responsible for these collections in the 18th verse. We're not told who the brother is, we're just told what his credentials are. First of all, his praise is in the gospel throughout all the ecclesias. Secondly, verse 19, he was also chosen of the ecclesias to travel with us with this grace. So he's one of the delegates for the fund. He's one of the appointed delegates from one of the areas that's now going to go down to Achaia. And if we are to read the idiom of the Greek properly, we might more correctly translate the opening phrase of verse 18, "And we have sent with him his brother," as the idiom of the Greek is more rightly expressed. So with Titus, verse 17, we have sent his brother. And if we were to ask, who is the brother of Titus? We make the suggestion, of course, and we believe with good reason, that the brother of Titus was none other than Luke himself. Let's think about his credentials, first of all. Was he a delegate of the fund? Verse 19, a man chosen of the ecclesias to travel with us. Well, yes, he was. If we come back to Acts chapter 20, let's just remind ourselves of that. Was Luke a delegate of the Jerusalem Poor Fund? Yes, he was. He was a delegate from a certain part of the ecclesial world. You'll remember in Acts chapter 20 and verse 4, we saw last Saturday some of the delegates who were going to accompany the apostle on his journey. It says there accompanied him into Asia, Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius of Derbe and Timotheus, and of Asia Tychicus and Trophimus. These going before tarried for us at Troas, and we sailed away from Philippi and came unto them to Troas, where we abode 7 days. And we believe that in the delicate wording of Acts 20, verses 4 to 6, we have the clue given to us that Luke, in fact, was the delegate from Philippi. But Luke is a modest writer, as all of the writers of the divine writ were. And Luke doesn't want particularly to stress the fact that he was one of the delegates. But he gives us the clue that he was because of the change of pronouns that they, first of all, went ahead, but they tarried for us and we came unto them. So we know from the 6th verse onwards that Luke has rejoined the company of the apostle just as they're about to go to Jerusalem with the fact we believe he was the delegate from Philippi. And that answers a problem, doesn't it? That there was no delegate from Philippi mentioned otherwise, which is unthinkable in view of the extreme generosity of the Philippians at all times. Unthinkable to imagine that the Philippian ecclesia of all ecclesias would not have had a delegate to represent their offerings for that fund. We believe Luke was the man. So first of all, in terms of the definition of the brother of the 2nd of Corinthians 8, that he was chosen to accompany us with this fund, yes, Luke was, we believe, a delegate. What about the phrase, back in the 2nd of Corinthians 8, verse 18, what about the phrase, whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the ecclesias? Well, there's two possible ways that we could read that phrase. One is that it is a reference to a gospel as written. And certainly from a review of our chart here, which we believe to be correct, there is absolutely no reason chronologically why the Gospel of Luke could not have been in existence and circulating at this particular time. So it's more than possible that Luke's Gospel was already known and circulated around the ecclesias before the occasion of this third journey, in which case the phrase praise in the Gospel may refer to Luke's endeavours in that regard. But it could also be simply that he was a well-known person in the work of proclaiming the truth. That Luke had travelled, we believe, by the way, that Luke originally came from Antioch. In which case it's quite possible that he travelled through the regions of Galatia and Asia before he'd ever come to Macedonia, and so he was known in many ecclesias for his own ability in spreading the truth. That's certainly how the Jerusalem Bible translates the phrase. It says, a man famous in all the ecclesias for spreading the gospel. Whatever we make of those phrases, we certainly believe that they would have appropriate application to Luke. And then finally, this phrase, this opening phrase in the 18th verse of 2 Corinthians 8, we've sent with him his brother. Was Luke the brother of Titus? Well, if he was, then it makes good sense of another puzzle that we have. And the puzzle, of course, is this. That Titus is probably the most prominent fellow helper of the apostle in this third journey. He figures prominently, of course, in the whole of the second epistle of the Corinthians. He was used extensively by the apostle in his labours during this third journey. He's never once mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles. Now, the third journey of the Apostle Paul is mentioned in Acts 18, 19, 20, 21. Never read of Titus once in those chapters. We know from Galatians 2 that there was another occasion when the Apostle took Titus with him to Jerusalem. And whatever visit it was, it doesn't matter, because Titus is never recorded in the Acts of the Apostles as ever going on another occasion with Paul to Jerusalem. In fact, he's never recorded at all. Now, why isn't Titus in Paul's third journey? And the answer is because Luke was his brother, and Luke's writing the story. And just as Luke doesn't put his own name forward and suggest that he was a delegate, so he discreetly omits reference to his brother's involvement as well. Just as in the Gospel of John, there is no reference to James, the son of Zebedee, who was John's own brother. Never find him in John's Gospel. The family ought never to be promoted in matters of scriptural writing. And maybe we believe that's the reason why Titus is not mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles, and that they were, in fact, brothers. And so we make the suggestion, therefore, that the brother that was sent in the 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 18 was indeed Luke, a man whose praise was in the Gospel, verse 19, and not that only, but who was also chosen of the ecclesias to travel with us with this grace which is administered by us. This grace, what was the grace administered by them? Well, of course, on this occasion the word charis is being used to describe the actual Jerusalem poor fund itself. He was a man chosen of the ecclesias. The Jerusalem Bible translates the word elected. And of course that was the point really of the 19th verse, irrespective of whether it was Luke or somebody else. The main point about this brother was that he was one of the official ecclesial delegates. He's not there because Paul has chosen him. That's what Paul's saying. He's not my personal choice. He's an official elected member by the ecclesias to accompany us on the journey for this particular fund, which is administered by us, he says, to the glory of the same Lord, or the glory of the Lord himself, as the phrase would be better rendered. The glory of the Lord himself. That's why they were administering this fund. It was going to be to the glory of the Lord himself. It wasn't for Paul. It wasn't really for the Jerusalem ecclesia. He wasn't doing any of this for himself. It was for the truth's sake and for Christ's sake that this particular matter was so zealously pursued by the apostle. And then he says in verses 20 and 21, this is a marvellous section, as the apostle now interrupts his consideration of the commissioners of the fund. He says, I want you to understand something that I've taken particular pains in this particular matter. In fact, one of the very reasons why the delegates were chosen in the first place. Because, says the apostle in verse 20, he says, I want to avoid this, that no man should blame us in this abundance which is administered by us, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Avoiding this, he says, that no man should blame us. And you know, when he says that should blame us, the apostle wasn't really worried about himself. What he was worried about was that no blame should attach to the fund. There was the apostle's real concern. Moffat says, I want to take precautions against any risk of suspicion. The Jerusalem Bible says, we hope that there, in this way there will be no accusations. The 20th century New Testament translation says, what we're specially guarding against is that any fault should be found. You know, the word blame in verse 20 means literally to carp at or discredit. I wonder who would be endeavouring to discredit the work of the fund. Well, of course, it was the Judaizers themselves, wasn't it? And the apostle was concerned that whatever they did, that there be no criticism levelled against the matter of the fund itself. He didn't want the matter of the collection in any way to be brought into question. And you know, one of the things that could have in fact generated that was, you see how he describes the fund in verse 20. He says, avoiding this, that no man should blame us in this abundance. Oh, that was an interesting word to choose. That word abundance is not the word perisia, to abound. It's not one of our theme words. It's the word hadrotes in the Greek, and it means literally plumpness. It's a reference to the bulging state of the bags. That no man should blame us in this plumpness. The RSV translates the word as liberal gift. Rotherham says this munificence. The Jerusalem Bible says so large a fund. And so you see, the very size of the fund made it important now that everything was accounted for properly. And what a subtle hint, of course, to the Achaean ecclesias, that the fund was already plump of size because others had responded generously. So the bags were already bulging. The apostle says, I've got a concern that there should be no criticism, no blame attached to this particular collection. So, verse 21, as a result of that, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. And here we have the example of the apostle with regard to the meticulous honesty that he wanted to show in this particular matter. You see, the quotation from concerning providing for honest things found in the 21st verse comes, in fact, from the Septuagint version of Proverbs 3 and verse 4. Do thou provide things honest in the sight of the Lord and of man. We can see how the spirit of that Proverbs passage is taken up here in several different New Testament applications. It's really the basis of the 1st of Thessalonians 5 when it talks about abstaining from all appearance of evil. It's the basis of the passage in the 1st of Timothy 3 and also the 1st of Timothy 5 about giving no occasion for adversaries to speak reproachfully. It's the very phrase used here in the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 8 concerning the fund. It's the same passage quoted by the apostle in Romans 12. Recompense to no man, evil for evil, provide things honest in the sight of all men. It's the theme of Colossians 4, walk in wisdom to them that are without. And it's the basis of the 1st of Thessalonians 4, walk honestly toward them that are without. Brother John Carter, in commenting upon the spirit of that passage, in his treatise on Romans, says that the spirit of that proverb was that actions that might be misunderstood should be avoided. I'll say that again. Actions that might be misunderstood should be avoided. And that was going to be the spirit of the apostle in this particular matter of the Jerusalem poor fund. Now, I'll tell you what, this is a remarkable thing when you think about it. The word providing, by the way, that's found in verse 21 here, the word providing is the Greek word proneo. And this is what it means. I want you to stop and think about the fullness of this meaning, providing. It means to consider in advance, to look out for beforehand by way of maintenance for others and by way of circumspection for oneself. To look out for beforehand by way of maintenance for others and by way of circumspection for oneself. That's exactly what the apostle wanted to do on this occasion. He saw looming dangers. He saw potential criticisms. He saw implications of how the fund could be discredited, and he moved to ensure that no criticism should be attached to that fund. Whatever he had to do, he would do that. By the way, when it says providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men, I wonder which of those two is the more difficult to achieve. The apostle knew his heart before the Father. But providing things honest in the sight of men and men who were hostile to his cause, that's a different matter indeed. And they were hostile, weren't they? Because they'd suggested, remember, that he was in fact... Well, come and have a look what they'd suggested in the 2 Corinthians chapter 12. This is why the apostle was so anxious, as he expresses in the 8th chapter, that no blame should be attached. He really was worried about what should happen in that regard. Now look at the 2 Corinthians chapter 12 in terms of what the problem was that the apostle was experiencing. Verse 13, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 13. For what is it wherein ye were inferior to other ecclesias, except it be that I myself was not burdensome to you? So he says, I'm awfully sorry, he says, I forgot to charge you. Forgive me this wrong, he says. There's a tremendous irony in the apostle's language here, isn't there? Now, just look at the words, verse 14. We can work out what the problem is. Behold, the third time I'm ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. And I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. But be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with God. Did I make a gain of you? Now, just look at all those terms, brothers and sisters, all related to money. You see them there? Verse 14. I seek not yours. Verse 14 again. Lay up. Verse 15. Spend. Be spent. Verse 17. Gain. They're all the terms of money. And you see, what the Judaizers had done, of course, and very successfully in the Corinthian ecclesia, was they'd suggested that, here is a man. Now you just stop and think about this. I tell you what, this is an amazing thing, what the apostle says in the 2 Corinthians 8 about providing for things honest. Just come back to that passage and we'll make our comments from there. Now just stop and think about this. Verse 20. Read it again, 2 Corinthians 8. Avoiding this, that no man should blame us. That no man should blame us in this abundance which is administered by us, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. You know, here is a brother who's given 3 years of his life for the gathering of this fund. Who sees it in such lofty terms that he personally equates it with the spirit of the sacrifice of Christ. That's how he saw it. Later on, he talks about offering up this collection as if it was a priestly ministration. And all the Judaizers could do was to turn around and say, he's a common thief. And he wants to put his fingers in the bag. Now, how would you feel if you were the apostle? And you've given 3 years of your life to that cause, to bind brethren together, Jew and Gentile, that they might see the grace of God at work amongst them all. And that's the sort of criticism that came about. How would you feel? You know, how easy it would be, brothers and sisters, to say, well, if that's the thanks you get, then I'm out. I'm finished. I resign. Forget it. Wouldn't it be easy to be like that? And you know, often those that do the most in the truth seem somehow to also endure the most criticism for what they do in the truth. You know what the apostle said? He said, it's my heart's desire to come to Achaia. He says, I want to come down to you more than anything else in the world. I want to come and complete that collection because it's my idea. It's been my thinking. This has been my spirit. And more than anything else, I believe, the apostle said, I would love to come and complete that collection. But if that's not going to be what will advance the cause of the truth, then I'll step aside. And I'll let someone else go.
and I'll stay behind. And I won't come down until brethren have been sent, until the collections have been finished, until the bags have been sealed, until the money's been counted, until the delegates have been voted and voted in, until everything's organised so that no criticism can attach to that fund. But it tore his heart out to have to stay behind. But he would do that if that's what was best for the truth. And isn't that the spirit? Isn't that the spirit of the apostle? What will be best for the truth? And he says, if what will be best for the truth is that I step aside so that no blame can be attached, then that's what I will do. Now, that's I tell you what, brothers and sisters, that's a wonderful spirit in the apostle. It's a very hard spirit to emulate at times when we suffer from criticism in our lives. Verse 22. And he says, we've sent with them our brother, whom we have oftentimes proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent upon the great confidence which I have in you. Whether any do inquire of Titus, he's my partner and fellow helper concerning you, or our brethren be inquired of, they are the messengers of the ecclesias and the glory of Christ. And so the apostle now comes back on to his consideration of the commissioners for the fund that he was going to send to Achaia in order that those collections might be completed. He was going to send Titus, and with Titus he was going to send, of course, his brother Luke, a man whose praise was in the gospel throughout all the ecclesias. And now there's a third brother mentioned in these two verses here. We've sent with them our brother, whom we've oftentimes proved diligent in many things. Who was the third brother? Well, let's just review what we've got. First of all, then, we believe Titus, described here as my partner and fellow helper, and therefore used by the apostle in his care for the ecclesias. A man who was at the conference, we believe, who twice visited Corinth to restore them to the truth, a man who laboured in Crete and who ultimately preached in Dalmatia, as the 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10 shows. A man who indeed had that spirit, that wonderful spirit of earnest care in everything he did. And with him came Luke, his brother, a man described as the beloved physician, and therefore a man who indeed learnt the principle of caring for others, including the apostle himself in his hour of trial. We believe that Luke was evidently a capable teacher of the truth, as many grateful ecclesias could testify, and perhaps the very generous spirit of the Philippian ecclesia, at least in measure, was a reflection of Luke's own attitude to the truth. And indeed, we read of that spirit in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 10. Who's the brother of verses 22 and 23? Well, look, we really don't know, but I make the suggestion here that it was in fact Tychicus. He's described here simply as, we've sent with them our brother. And you know, if ever there was a man who could be described in the records as the brother sent, it was in fact this man, Tychicus, because on several different occasions he was sent by the apostle to accomplish certain objectives. He was sent with Titus to Corinth, we believe here. He obviously accompanied the apostle to Rome, because in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 21, the apostle Paul says, I have sent Tychicus to you. And in Colossians chapter 4, he was also sent that he might know their estate. He was sent to Crete. He was sent again to Ephesus in the 2 Timothy chapter 4. Tychicus was preeminently the brother sent by the apostle all over the world to accomplish various things. A faithful brother, whom, as the apostle Paul says here, we've oftentimes proved diligent in many things. What do you think the word messengers would be in verse 23? They are the messengers of the ecclesias. What do you think that word would be in the Greek? Well, it could be, what could it be? It could be agalos, couldn't it? But in fact here it's apostolos. What does apostolos mean? The sent ones. One sent. So, whether any do inquire of Titus, he's my partner, or our brethren, they are the ones sent from the ecclesias. And Tychicus certainly, we believe, was one such man who was sent on several different occasions by the apostle to perform various labours. One thing interesting about these three men that you might notice is this. The last chapter that the apostle ever wrote to any man was, of course, the 2nd of Timothy chapter 4. Titus is mentioned in the 2nd of Timothy 4 verse 10. Luke is mentioned in the 2nd of Timothy 4 verse 11. And Tychicus is mentioned in the 2nd of Timothy chapter 4 verse 12. They were all there with the apostle right to the end, these three particular men. They are all found in the very last letter that the apostle writes. Irrespective of whether it was, look, I don't know, let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. It's nice to try and work out who they were, isn't it? Perhaps to have some knowledge of who they might be. But irrespective of who they were, what we do know is that they had that spirit of earnest care concerning the ecclesias. So Titus had that earnest care, verse 16, and so also this brother, who has oftentimes proved to be earnestly caring, verse 22, and many think, where did they get that spirit from? These delegates, these commissioners that were going to go down to Achaia on behalf of the apostle, where did they get that earnestly, zealously caring spirit from? Well, I'll tell you where they got it from, in Galatians chapter 2. Here's where they got that spirit from. How was it that Titus and Luke and the other brother, be it Tychicus or whoever, why is it that they were imbued with that spirit of zealous care in the work of ecclesial life? Well, here's who they got it from. Galatians 2, verse 10. Only they would that we should remember the poor, the same which I also was earnestly caring to do. Same word, spoudae. It was the apostle's zeal for that matter. And he inspired those other men with the very spirit that he had towards that fund. That's where they got it from. The apostle was a man who was able to infect others with his enthusiasm. And so thrilled that Titus and Luke and Tychicus come by the spirit that the apostle was endeavouring to inspire, that they drew, as it were, that same earnest care from the very apostle himself, and they marched off to Achaia as the delegates who would go down there to complete the fun in the apostle's absence, but his heart would go with them, brothers and sisters, indeed. So we come back then to the 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and to the concluding phrases. You know, really what the apostle is saying is this. He says, I know that I can't come. I know that there are those who will discredit the fund if I personally come and attend to these collections. I'd love to come, he says. But in order to provide for things honest in the sight of all men, and that no blame should be attached, he says, I know I have to stay behind. But he says, I tell you what, the men that we're going to send have got my spirit. And I know they've got my attitude. And can you just imagine those three men walking into the ecclesias of Achaia, walking into the ecclesia of Achaia? I can just see that. In come Titus and Luke and Tychicus, breathing the spirit of earnest care. I tell you what, the money came pouring in. You know, it's always been the case, hasn't it, that the example of a few can inspire and motivate others. The infectious enthusiasm of just a few that are committed to the truth. I tell you what, they turned those collections around. By the time the apostle came, the bags were finished, tied up, sealed, counted, and beyond his expectations. And that certainly was his desire as he closes with these words in the 24th verse. Wherefore, he says, when they come, these men that I'm sending, these earnestly caring commissioners, when they do come, he says, verse 24, show ye to them and before the ecclesias the proof of your love and of our boasting on your behalf. As one translation says, and I'm sure this is the spirit of the apostle's words, so he says, so do let them and all the ecclesias see how genuine is your love and justify all the nice things we've said about you. And so on that note, the apostle concluded this chapter as he sought to lift their thinking, to inspire them to the giving towards that fund on the basis of loving mutual cooperation for the good of others. That spirit of sharing that was shown in Israel of old, when he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack.